Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
We cannot engage directly or indirectly in management of labor union.
Disappeared from sight here at the Marcus Red Fox restaurant. The FBI is up against the stone wall in their investigation.
Intensive investigation into his disappearances.
Welcome, I'm Eric Shaw. You're listening to Riddle, the podcast, my companion series of the Fox Nation show, Riddle, the search for James R. Hoffa. Teamsters leader Jimmy Hoffa disappeared on July 30th, 1975, and our episodes detail our Fox Nation investigation of the case. With us now, Jack Goldsmith. You know, there are only two suspects in the Hoffa case still alive. Jack's stepfather, Chucky O'Brien, is one. Authorities have long considered Chucky a prime suspect, claiming he may have driven Jimmy Hoffa to his death, perhaps unwittingly, by driving him to a mob meeting where he was killed. Jack, though, has a different story. He's written an honest, refreshing, and deeply told tale of his stepfather and the cause that has so long haunted him. He argues that, among many other reasons, because of the FBI official timeline, that does not give Chucky the time to have driven Hoffa. The book has been praised. It is called In Hoffa's Shadow, A Stepfather, A Disappearance in Detroit, and My Search for the Truth. Jack was also the Deputy Attorney General of the United States in the George W. Bush administration and is current professor of law at Harvard and a prominent constitutional expert. You have an amazing life. First, tell those who are listening from your experience in the Justice Department, the top constitutional lawyer at Harvard in the country, and you're Chucky O'Brien's stepson.
Well, I'm not sure I'm the top constitutional lawyer in the country, but I do practice and teach constitutional law of various forms. Chucky O'Brien is my stepfather. He was one of the leading suspects in the Hoffa disappearance. He remains that. And I was 12 years old when he became my stepfather and when Hoffa disappeared.
What was that like back then?
It was very strange, very, very strange, to put it mildly. You know, Chucky had just come into my life. I hadn't had a father figure, really. I was really, really, really close to him. I adored him. And then all of a sudden, the Hoffa thing happened. And, you know, our whole lives got turned upside down because he was on the front page of every newspaper. And he was associated with all these criminals that I didn't know about, people I got to know later very well. And, you know, the press was all over us. The government was all over us. It was kind of a crazy time.
Now, meanwhile, you had this parallel life. Briefly, if you can, describe what you did at the Justice Department under the George W. Bush administration, friends with Comey, and you were right there in the middle of the enhanced interrogation issue.
Sure. In October of 2003, I was confirmed by the Senate to be the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Office of Legal Counsel, and that is the office that exercises authority delegated from the president and the attorney general to determine legal issues for the government, for the executive branch. Soon after I got there, as has been known for a long time now, I discovered problems with the interrogation program and with the warrantless wiretapping program. I spent the next 9 months trying to put those in a better legal foundation. That's the short version.
So you are dealing with the top national security issues of this nation. At the same time, a parallel track as being Chucky's stepson, a man you love, who is the center of the Hoffa investigation for decades.
Correct. And indeed, it came together. In my book, I opened the book with this scene. Those two worlds of mine came together. I hadn't spoken to Chucky in 20 years. I'd kind of cut him out of my life. The only reason I was at the Justice Department, I wouldn't have gotten the security clearances I needed had I not cut him out of my life. And one night, I hadn't thought about Chucky in decades, really, not much. And one night I was working on this program, the warrantless wiretapping program, and I came across a citation to two old cases, O'Brien versus United States and Hoffa versus United States, which opened a whole door onto an earlier era of illegal surveillance that involved Chucky and Hoffa. So that was my two traumatic worlds kind of collided.
And you, the book is so real and so honest. I commend you for this.
Thank you.
As I've said in the intro, it's In Hoffa's Shadow, an amazing book that I think our listeners have to read. And you talk about the abuses of the government back then, listening in on the suspects, listening in on Chucky, listening in on Tony Jack, Anthony Giacalone, illegally and trying to come up with this case that they have not yet officially solved.
Right. So this is the episodes I have them that I discussed with the government illegally bugging and listening in to Chucky and Anthony Giacalone and Josephine Hoffa, Hoffa's wife, and Chucky's mom, Sylvia Pagano, and lots of other amazing characters, including lots of mobsters. That was an earlier era of illegal government surveillance, and it was widespread and unregulated, and it kind of opened up a world, this kind of amazing world of the government just listening in 24/7 mm-hmm. to people's lives. So, yeah.
And in the book, you lay out the case that the narrative involving Chucky, that the investigators believing that he picked up Jimmy Hoffa in the parking lot of the Marcus Red Fox, that started basically the night he disappeared with James P. Hoffa having suspicions of Chucky.
Yeah. James P. Hoffa, who is Jimmy Hoffa's son and whom Chucky actually had a large hand in raising because Chucky was so close to Hoffa. The night of the disappearance, or really the next day, he pointed the finger at Chucky. He believed Chucky was involved for a whole bunch of reasons. They had a dispute. They had tensions going back decades. He pointed the finger at Chucky. The FBI told me, and clearly were in retrospect, influenced by what he said. There was some circumstantial evidence, quite a lot of it, pointing to Chucky in the area, maybe being involved. So it was completely understandable why he became a suspect early on.
And what has that done to Chucky's life?
Well, first of all, he's always claimed that he wasn't involved in the disappearance. As I try to explain in the book, I think that's right. I give reasons why. I explain why the FBI thinks he's not involved. Obviously, it turned his life completely upside down, and frankly, it ruined it. Hoffa was like a father to him. Many people believe he was Hoffa's real son, his illegitimate child out of wedlock. I don't believe that's true. I talk about that in the book. But he was really, really close to Hoffa, and you know, he'd always told me when I was a boy, he never could have done that. He loved Hoffa too much, and he would have taken a bullet for Hoffa. And you know, he did things like that over the course of his life. So being accused credibly of being the person who was involved in Hoffa's disappearance, you know, it destroyed him really, and not to mention the collateral impact of his reputation and. But really, it was his honor that was most destroyed and that upset him the most.
And the theory that he picked him up in Tony Jack's son's car, mm-hmm. unwittingly driving him to what he thought was a meeting. Your view of that?
Yeah. So I just there's literally no evidence for it. We don't have any evidence, and I talked to a lot of FBI agents on the record in my book. There's no evidence at all of what happened in that parking lot that day. They know the only reason that they suspect that Hoffa got in a car with someone is because he disappeared, and they assumed that if he had been overcome involuntarily in the parking lot, someone would have seen it. But even that's an assumption. So I go through, I don't have time to get into it now. I go through in the book all of the reasons why the circumstantial case against Chucky doesn't hold up and all the independent reasons to think he couldn't have been involved and the FBI's new theory. But, you know, really the story that Chucky picked up Hoffa that day was premised on the assumption that there aren't many other people Hoffa would have gotten in the car with voluntarily. And I'm pretty confident that the circumstances under which Chucky supposedly picked Hoffa up, there's no chance Hoffa would have gotten in the car then either. He had been waiting in the parking lot an hour and a half. He hadn't spoken to Chucky in 6 months. He wasn't supposed to see Chucky that day. It's very hard to believe, independent of everything else, he would have just gotten in the car.
In our series, in our first one, dealing with Frank Sheeran and his claims, and now our second show on Fox Nation, Riddle, the Search for James R. Hoffa, Phil Muscato Jr. says that Hoffa was killed by Sally Baguglio. It was all arranged by Tony Pro Provenzano, Genovese crime family, New Jersey. And Phil says that it is Sally Bugs who shot Hoffa. What is your view?
I don't have an informed view. I really don't. I do believe that Tony Pro was involved. There's lots of circumstantial evidence to support that, a lot of metadata analysis that hasn't been made public to support that. Chucky told me in the book that Tony Breaux had a lot to do with it. That's one of the things he told me about the disappearance. I don't have any reason for or against Sally Bugs. The FBI agents I've spoken to don't believe he was involved, although they did early on, in large part because they think there was evidence that he was actually in New Jersey at the time. They think they have telephone information records that show he was in New Jersey. But none of this evidence is conclusive, so I certainly can't say that Sally Bugs didn't do it.
Scott Bernstein in Detroit, who you talked to for the podcast, believes that Tony Powell, then a low-level mobster in Detroit, may have shot him in a house. Adam Aldea, of course, thinks that or says that that Tony Breaux was in Detroit at the time. What about Frank Sharon and his claim?
So, for reasons I explained at length in the New York Review of Books essay that I wrote, I think the Sharon claim is preposterous for a whole bunch of reasons. It's first of all, the book is just full of falsehoods, starting in the first paragraph. Sharon has lied so many times over the course of his life about his involvement. There's no evidence, not a single piece that I've seen that actually affirmatively supports the case that he was involved. And the circumstances under which he claims to have been involved, last second flight into Detroit, Hoffa was supposed to meet him and didn't hear from him, and then he shows up with all of these, with all of the kind of trail of evidence that would have left. There was just no reason for the mob to use him. And the meeting at Vesuvio's afterwards, I don't know if you get into that on this podcast, but
go ahead.
The whole premise of that meeting, which was to see if Sharon was loyal to Tony Breaux, wouldn't make any sense if Sharon had actually just knocked Hoffa off. They never would have been meeting with Sharon if he had just knocked Hoffa off. There are dozens of reasons why I don't believe that story.
The Vesuvio's was a few days later, a restaurant, 47th Street, 48th Street here in New York,
right,
where they had a meeting. I met Sharon. He was trying to sell his book, said he shot off in the head, gave directions to the house. We found blood evidence, potential blood evidence, 50 samples tested by the FBI. 28 were human blood. What got me was that it was in the pattern of a hit. Most of the blood by the door where Hoffa's head would have hit the floor, 7 drops going down the hallway. But no DNA match.
Right.
And other circumstantial evidence against Sharon, as well as these new claims that make more sense. Do you think the mob would have used a guy who wasn't even a sworn made member of the mob? He's Irish,
right?
To carry out the biggest mob hit in the history of organized crime.
They might have. I doubt that they wouldn't use a made man, but there's no chance they would have done it under these circumstances. Sharon says he's not necessary to his own plot. He says he flew in from Ohio, I think, into Detroit, where he, for the first time in his life, meets Sally Bugs and Tony Andretta, and for the first time meet Chucky, and then they all go to pick up Hoffa, and then take him to his death. There's so many things that might have gone wrong there, that people that didn't know one another hadn't planned the thing together. It's inconceivable. I'll say one other thing. Beaverland Street was where the house was, right?
Yes.
And it was in Detroit. The timeline doesn't work if Chucky was supposedly involved. Chucky was known to have been in at Viola Holmes's house until 2:30 that afternoon. Sharon actually claims that they showed up at 2:30 to meet Hoffa. Chucky, in their account, had to drive from where Viola was all the way down to Beaverland Street, 20, 25 minutes, all the way back to pick up Hoffa, about 20 minutes, and then all the way back another 20 minutes where he was killed. It's just the timeline doesn't work, and Hoffa would not have sat idly in a car for 9 or 10 miles from the Moccasin to Beaverland Street with a bunch of people he'd never met before except for Chucky. It just doesn't make any sense.
And finally, just on this, do you know how Sharon got in the Hoffex memo? Because that's what keyed my interest. He's up there number 6 or 7.
Yeah.
But it only says
he's the last one
in
Detroit. He's the last one mentioned out of— it's not— I don't think it's 6 or 7. Okay. He's the last one mentioned out of, I think it's a dozen suspects.
Yeah.
I don't know how he got in the memo. I mean, he was, you know, basically that memo included everyone that informants said might have been involved. And it's a good question. You know, it's a good question how he got in the memo. I might try to figure out the answer to that. I think I can figure out the
answer.
Oh,
please do.
Yeah.
Please do and get back to me.
I will.
The timeline, and you describe it. You have at the end of the book a detailed timeline that you say shows that Chuck, it's impossible. It could not have happened. Can you, for our listeners, describe what the timeline is and why it shows that Chucky could not have done this?
So it's very complicated in the appendix. I try to lay it out as clearly as I can, but I think I can, in a few sentences, state the basic points. So the FBI focused on the fact, and it's true, that Chucky did not have, no one had seen Chucky for a couple of hours the afternoon during which Hoffa disappeared. And the 2 hours in which Chucky wasn't seen by anyone that they could find, between the time he left Viola Holmes' home at about 2:20 or 2:30 and was seen again sometime around 4 or 4:30 at local 299, they thought that that 2 hours of was suspicious and pointed to the fact that he was doing something to kill Hoffa. As I point out in the appendix and earlier in the book, that is the wrong way of looking at it. The right way of looking at it is, what was the time in which Hoffa was last known to be alive, and what was the, and then what was the next time in which Chucky was seen by witnesses to be somewhere? Hoffa was last known to be alive as late as between 3:20 and 3:30 that afternoon. There's tons of grand jury evidence in support of that. If that's the case, Chucky was seen by several people back at 299 around 4 to 4:15 that afternoon. That would have left him practically no time and almost certainly no time. It seems impossible for him to have picked up Hoffa at 3:30 after 3:30, taken him to his killers, went to drop off the car at pick up Joey Jackalone and then go back to local 299. He didn't have time to do it. And this is what the FBI meant when they told me when I met with them in 2012 that they, I think, that they concluded that it was impossible that Chucky was in that parking lot that afternoon.
That's Andy Sluss, the at the time,
correct,
the head Hoffa FBI investigator for the FBI. That what you just said basically blows a hole in Sharon, because Sharon and the book claim, and the movie, I would assume, claim that it was, he was picked up at about 2:30 to 2:40.
Yeah, so that's another huge problem. There's many, many problems with Sharon's account, but they said he was picked up between 2:30 and 2:40. They said that because everything in Sharon's confession basically tracks the Hoffex memo and then inserts himself into the Hoffex memo. And that's just one of the mistakes in the Hoffex memo. They think Hoffa disappeared around 2:40, 2:45, they say in the Hoffex memo. But again, there was later evidence that developed. It's all laid out in the grand jury, which I talk about. And he spoke to Louis Lento at 3:30 that afternoon from a payphone near the in that parking lot. So that's just another piece of evidence in the record that's inconsistent with what Sharon said.
In January, I wrote an article calling for the release of the Hoffa files. I said unredacted. Do you think it's possible that it can – it should, well, the Hoffa family wants it out. James P., as well as Barbara Kranzer, who's now 81 years old or so, they deserve to know the truth. I think the nation deserves to know the truth. The Teamster members to for your family to get it out, what would you – do you think that's possible? What would you like to see happen?
I certainly agree with you that the only person who's alive who was a suspect in the case, possibly, the only person besides the Hoffas who could be affected adversely is Chucky. And it's in Chucky's interest for these files to be open because I believe that they will show what I show in my book, which was that he was innocent. I do hope that the government finds a vehicle for, again, I don't know if the right thing to do is to release all the files, redacted or unredacted, but they should tell us what they know and why and provide us with some supporting documents. You know, this was the one of the most notorious disappearances and murders in American history. The FBI has had the case open for 44 years. There's now a major motion picture that's going to establish a public record on this that's entirely contrary to what the FBI thinks. It's hurting the Hoffa family. It's hurting Chucky. I think that they should release it, especially since, if I could just add one more thing, as I explain in the book, they promised Chucky that they would send him, give him an exonerating letter, that he wasn't a target or suspect in the disappearance. He did everything they asked. And then, as I explain in the book, they didn't follow through. So they owe it to him. I think they owe it to the Hoffa family.
Do you fear that the film The Irishman is going to show a false portrait that will be indelible and be the legacy of Chucky O'Brien when it's not true?
I mean, I don't fear that. I know that. That's just a piece of reality. The film, which I haven't seen, but it seems clear from the book it's based on and from the snippets of the film that it does portray Chucky picking up Hoffa, taking him to his death. I mean, the marginal harm to Chucky, everybody thinks that he did it anyway. So I'm not sure what the marginal harm of a film, the film is, since that's been conventional wisdom for 44 years. But I do think that it will probably become part of popular lore. I guess the FBI could change that if they open their records and establish definitively what the truth is, because I think the truth is far, far different from what's portrayed in that movie.
And your goal now?
My goal now, I mean, my goal has basically completed in having written this book. I did what I could to exonerate Chucky. I think I told the truth about him and the very complicated situation he was in. I wrote the book in large part to, you know, try to give him a fairer shake than history's given him. I think I succeeded in that, but I certainly don't have the resources to take on the popular culture avalanche that's about to take over the country on streaming Netflix.
And finally, how's Chucky doing, and what do you think he would want people to know?
Chucky is not in great health. His mind is still as sharp as it ever was, but he's not in great health. I know that Chucky wants people to know that he worked his whole life in labor. He did everything he could for the working man and woman. He loved Jimmy Hoffa, and he wasn't involved in the disappearance.
Jack Goldsmith, professor at Harvard Law School, but perhaps more importantly, stepson, loving and dedicated stepson to Chucky O'Brien. The book in Hoffa's shadow, A Stepfather, A Disappearance in Detroit, and My Search for the Truth. Jack, thank you.
Thank you so much, Eric.
You have been listening to Riddle, the podcast. Watch our show, Riddle, the Search for James R. Hoffa, on our streaming service, Fox Nation, and news reports on the Fox News Channel. Thank you for listening. I'm Eric Schoen.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.